Hello, I'm Harry Bucknell. Thank you for downloading this special edition of the Oldie Podcast, marking the 80th anniversary of the capture of General Heinrich Kreiper in May 1944 by the Greek Andartes and members of the Cretan section of Force 133 of the Special Operations Executive, led by Major Sir Patrick Lee Fermor. Theodorakis' theme tune for Ill Met by Moonlight, Michael Powell and Emmerich Pressburger's 1957 film starring Dirk Bogarde, David Oxley, Marius Goring, adapted from the 1950 book of the same name written by Billy Moss of the Coldstream Guards. The second command of the SOE operation, which immortalised one of the most audacious, daring and dashing episodes of the Second World War, the kidnapping of one of the Wehrmacht's most senior officers on the Nazi-occupied island of Fortress Crete, General Heinrich Kreiper. By the Greek Andartes under Manoli Patarakis and Georgios Tarakis, an imposterous caper that could almost have been torn from the pages of the boy's own paper. It was led by the late Major Sir Patrick Lee Fermor, a legendary figure of Elizabethan proportion and arguably one of the greatest travel writers of all time, who beguiled his adoring followers with tales of walking across Europe, life in Greece, and collections of letters, with books such as A Time of Gifts, Rumeli, and A Time to Keep Silence. Even now, Paddy, who died in 2011, remains a latter-day hero, whose work is synonymous with the romance of Byron, the rhetoric of Pericles, and the poetry of Homer. In the spring edition of the Oldie magazine, you can read a piece I wrote about the great man himself. To discuss the Kreiper kidnapping, in an interview recorded 3 years ago, I'm joined by former Chief of the General Staff, General Sir Michael Jackson. I hope you enjoy the programme.
I'd like to go back to late 1943, the war is turning in our favour, and in a bathroom in Cairo, Paddy Lee Fermor is having a bath, and in his room, a guest with him, is the young Captain Billy Moss, 3rd Coldstream, who has just come from the battlefields of North Africa, and they are hatching a plan to capture General Friedrich Müller, who was then much feared commander of the 22nd Air Lang Division on Crete. What, in your view, is the sort of, would be today, your take on such a hare-bear scheme?
We should remember that in late 43, Paddy was able to smuggle off the island, Crete, the Italian commander, because Italy had just switched sides, if you recall. And that I think, gave him the idea, let's not capture another Allied general. Let us get an enemy general. A bold plan and boldly executed. But like all special operations, it can take a disproportionate amount of resources to put it into effect. And you have this, and it's true today, you have this balance, this judgment to make as to whether a disproportionate use of resources is borne out by the effect of the special operation itself. There's no formula. That's a matter of commander's judgment.
It was a tale of great daring do, and it is one of those tales that falls into British military folklore to this very day. It is an example to us all. But actually, the effect of capturing a general at the time was probably of little effect. Is that fair to say?
I think it is. One salutes the daring do. One salutes the bold execution. One salutes the difficulty of exfiltration down to the southern coast to be taken off by the Royal Navy. All of that goes without saying. But what the operational value of one newly promoted three-star German general was in the greater scheme of things is harder to come to a conclusion. We should remember, Harry, we're only 6 weeks away from D-Day. There was the grand strategic design. And one could say, I say, well, anyway, denigrating the extraordinary event, that this was perhaps not much more than a spectacular tactical operation.
If you strike a blow against the Germans without shedding a drop of German blood as the player, and unfortunately there was the driver, the general's driver, was a casualty, but otherwise not a drop of German blood was shed. It was all done by stealth and planning and speed.
Paddy Firmer explained the aim, rationale, methodology of the operation in an interview recorded for the South Bank Show in the 1980s.
The other dimension is the psychological effect. For the home team, and indeed for the away team, the opponents, although I note that the reaction of the German garrison was not perhaps what one might have expected. There was a certain amount of drink taken by the garrison because they got rid of a rather unpleasant general officer commanding.
Because had the weather not played against him, he would have captured General Müller, who was the butcher of Kreta.
Quite so. Müller was replaced before the operation actually took place. Originally scheduled for February, but the Mediterranean played its red card and the weather delayed it till, as you say, until April, late April.
On the night of the 26th of April 1944, dressed as two German military policemen, Lee Firmer and Moss stopped Kreipe's unescorted staff car as the general was being driven to his quarters at Villa Ariadne, outside Knossos.
Is this the Gerhauswagen? Yeah.
Right. Come on! Himmelherrgott!
An excerpt from the 1957 film Ill Met by Moonlight, as Dirk Bogarde and David Oxley, in the role of Patrick Lee Firmer and Billy Moss respectively, capture General Kreipe, played by Marius Goring. In a 1970s interview on Greek television with Nico Mastorakis, General Kreipe and Patrick Lee Firmer recalled the moment of capture.
I was on the Fahrt in my Quartier, and an einer Kurve stand plötzlich ein deutscher Posten anhielt.
I was on the way to the headquarters when two men in German uniforms stopped us on a curve. Who are you? What do you want? I asked. It was very strange to stop us without any reason. Your papers, please, said Major Firmer or the other man. My mistake was to come out of the car. By the time I did it, some others, how they call them, partisans, came out of the bushes, threw me on the ground and tied me up. They forced me into the car and with a German gun pointing my head, we drove to Heraklion. Later on, we stopped and they took me out of the car again. Firmer came out with me.
Well, the moment the car slowed down, we dressed up as German corporals. I went to the left-hand door, opened it, seized the general. No, I didn't seize the general at once. I saw who he was by his medals and asked him for his papers. And he said, I'm General Kreipe. And I caught hold of him, pulled him out, and the other boys immediately took care of him, tied him up, and put him in the back of the car. Meanwhile, my second-in-command, Captain Moss, had opened the other door, hit the driver on the head, taken him out, jumped into the driver's seat, and then I immediately jumped in beside him where the general had been sitting, wearing the general's hat, which had fallen off in the road. And all the other boys, Saviolakis, Patirakis, Tirakis, jumped in, and off we went. And we only did it just in the nick of time, because it took just about a minute, and the moment we moved off, a whole stream of German cars, German troop-carrying cars full of German soldiers passed by, so we did it just in the nick of time.
After a hair-raising drive passing unhindered through 22 checkpoints around the Cretan capital of Heraklion, a journey eased by the general's insistence that his car, of all cars, be waved through, negating the very reason the measure had been implemented in the first place, the vehicle was abandoned in the countryside with a note attached to it detailing Kreiper's kidnapping as the work of SOE, signed by the two British officers, in the hope that it would deter the Nazis from the common practice of exacting violent and disproportionate revenge on the local population. The party took to the hills of Mount Ida in an 18-day game of cat and mouse, evading spotter aircraft and every resource at the disposal of General Brauer, the German commander on Crete, and his 30,000-strong garrison stationed on the island. Hiding in caves, using the ground to their advantage, and with the support of the Cretans, Lee Fermor and the Andartes made their way south with their precious captive to a rendezvous with the Royal Naval Corvette for safe onward extraction to the British headquarters in Egypt.
It is a great swashbuckling adventure in the true sort of style of Sir Walter Raleigh and all the great adventures of yesteryear. And in that sense, Paddy very much lived up to the character. I mean, he didn't just dress down. I mean, he dressed up as a Cretan shepherd in the full regalia, didn't he?
Yes, he did indeed. The British Army in the Second War, without doubt, attracted some rather esoteric characters, mainly in the officer corps, but not exclusively so. And without doubt, Paddy was one of those esoteric characters. And swashbuckling in the sense of the piratical context works quite well, I think.
He had a great sense of honour about him, didn't he? Because his relationship with the general, he very much respected the general's rank and in some cases almost could be considered as almost looked after him, didn't he?
I think Kreiper found the going quite heavy because those Cretan mountains are very rugged. Mm. And I'm not saying he was actually carried by his captors, but yes, I think there was a sense almost of Paddy thinking he was a wartime ADC here. Because if they had been recaptured or Kreiper had died on exfiltration, then the operation would have not had anything like, it seems to me, the same psychological effect. So operationally, it was sensible for Paddy to look after his German general and get him off the island alive.
There was that great moment up on Mount Ida when, as the dawn broke and lit the mountain, Lee Fermor heard the general muttering the first line of Horace's ode to Thalacchiacus.
About 3 days after we'd captured him, right up at the top of Mount Ida, in a cave, we both discovered that we got the same passion for classical literature, and that was a great bond between us. One morning we were looking across the Amari's Alley, and there was the top of Mount Ida, covered with snow, and he murmured to himself, the beginning of the ninth ode in the first book of Horace, Vides ut altas det nive candidum soracte, see Soracte's mighty peak is white with snow. And by marvellous stroke of luck, it's one of the very few poems of Horace that I know by heart. So I was able to go on, nec iam sustineant onus, suve laborantes geluque flumina constiterint acuto. And he looked very surprised, and his blue eyes gazed at me, and then he said, ach so, Herr Major. And I said, ja, Herr General. And we realized that we'd both of us drunk at the same fountains years ago, and if all of a sudden it seemed as if the war had come to an end, and things were very different between us after that.
Paddy Lee Fermor recording an interview with the South Bank Show, that celebrated moment, the unexpected bond with General Kreiper formed through a passion of classical literature. We had drunk from the same fountains, he said, that legendary line and a reminder of the chivalrous unwritten coda which exists between the warrior classes based on discipline, learning and honour.
But it's interesting that both Kreiper and Paddy knew that passage. They were both classicists of a kind. Whether one would find that today, I think, is arguable.
You certainly wouldn't from this old Raven, that's for sure. But I think that Paddy perhaps almost protected the general from the enthusiasm, shall we say, of Michia Kumeniakis and his Andartes, who I think were just too keen to get their hands on a German general. And I think it was perhaps his leadership that got the general through the entire exercise. Would that be fair to say?
Yeah, I think that's fair. I mean, any such endeavour needs a strong leader with clarity of understanding of what he's about, what the aim is. I mean, all of this is not anything new, but I think under the circumstances, and remember, the whole German garrison was out looking, and they had a couple of very close shaves to look after your captain in every way. Seems to me the most sensible course to take. You want to get him off the island alive and in reasonable shape. If you don't do that, it seems to me you're pulling the rug from under the whole enterprise.
On the night of the 14th of May 1944, despite there being a strong German presence all around, Lee Fermor and the Cretan Andartes managed to get the general to within reach of a cove near Rodokino on the south coast of Crete. In abducting a general, he describes the excitement as the place began to fill up like a drawing room. It seemed to us all, with its walls of rock on either side, and the sand and the pebbles, the lapping of the water, and the stars, a quiet place for our adventure to end, he wrote. Signalling to bring the ship in, which could be heard somewhere offshore, was to begin at 10 p.m. The problem, however, was that the Morse code sequence had been changed from M for Monkey, K for King, using the old military phonetic alphabet, to Sugar Baker. Remarkably, no one knew the sequence of dots and dashes for a B in Morse code. Such can be the perils of prolonged periods in operations. Fearing compromise, the sound of the vessel began to grow faint and hearts sank until Captain Dennis Ciclatera appeared on the scene. Tim Bentinck reads Paddy's account from abducting a general.
This agony was suddenly resolved by the arrival of Dennis, who was also due to leave. Fortunately, he knew the Morse code, and we started desperately flashing with the correct signal. And, at last, faint at first, then gradually louder, the sound of the ship came to us, and a great sigh of relief rose from the waterline. It occurs to me now that we ought to have asked the general. He must have been as eager to go now as we were. Did we not think of it, or was it shame at our amateur status? There was a slight coil of mist over the sea, so it was not till she was quite close that we saw the ship. We could hear the rattle of the anchor going down. Then two boats were lowered. They headed for the shore, full of dark shapes. We had forgotten all about George Jellicoe's raiding forces. We could soon see that the boats were manned by figures in berets and jerkins, all bristling with submachine guns. When the keels touched the pebbles, they leapt into the shallow water and rushed ashore, full tilt. I heard someone shout my name. They thought we might have had to retreat, fighting to the rendezvous. When they saw that we were unsoiled, I think that they were all a bit downcast, especially the commander, who was not Jellicoe, but Bob Berry, whom I hadn't seen for 3 years. I introduced him to all the party and to the guerrilla leaders who were crowding about us in a state of great jubilation, and to the general. He bowed stiffly, shook hands and said, "Sehr gefällig, Herr General." In a perfect accent. The moment had come. Bob Berry and his commandos emptied their rucksacks of all their stores and cigarettes and handed them over to those of our companions who were remaining. We all pulled off our boots to leave behind. This was always done. Even in rags they came in useful. Soon we were saying goodbye to Petraka and the Rodokino Capitans and Yanni Katsias and the guerrillas, and lastly to Antony Zoidakis. We all embraced like grizzly bears. I tried to persuade Antony to come with us. He wavered a moment and then decided against it. I wish he had. A sailor said, "Excuse me, sir, but we ought to get a move on." As we neared the ship, the figures waving along the shore had begun to grow indistinct among the shadows, and, very fast, it was hard to single out the cove from the tremendous mountain mass that soared from the sea to the Milky Way. The ship grew larger, her pom-poms and Bofors anti-aircraft guns shining in the starlight. When we drew alongside, sailors in spotless white were reaching down into the bulwarks to guide the general up the rope ladder. "That's right, sir. Easy does it." While we, Billy, Manoli, and George and I, helped from below. A moment later, we were on the deck in our bare feet, and it was all over.
The sadness, of course, was in the process that the general's driver, who was Kosh on the head, died in the process. I think Paddy always felt that. Perhaps greater than that was that when Muller came back from the Dodecanese, having recaptured them from the British, as a very successful soldier in his own right, he then embarked on the holocaust of Kedros, where basically half the Amari Valley was then torched and burnt. And I think that always played on Paddy's mind. But do you think that it was fair to say that that was used as an excuse to mask the German withdrawal from Crete in general?
I don't know the answer for that as to the purpose behind the outrages that took place. Was it a form of retaliation? If it was, they left it quite a while. It was August, I think, before the burning and the looting and everything else took place. You can argue that if they were going to do that, they would have done it right away. As soon as they learned Private was off the island, and that the operation probably could not have taken place without partisan support, then they'd have gone straight away. So the delay may indeed be part of the run-up to the German withdrawal from Crete.
Looking back, what is your view on Paddy as a figure in history? What does he mean to you?
Well, I go back to a moment ago. Long may the British Army have its rather derring-do, esoteric T. Lawrence style of leaders. And Paddy was right there, well supported by Billy. I know out of interest that Paddy insisted that the glory should be equally shared amongst all taken part. But at the end of the day, Paddy got the Distinguished Service Order, Billy the lesser ranking military cross. But so be it. So the Paddies of the British Army, still, I'm glad to say, to be found. And long may that be so.
Well, General Mike Jackson, thank you so much for being such a wonderful guest, as always.
But as our great nation seems caught in an interminable and hopeless tailspin that drives it ever deeper into a mire of mediocrity, insignificance, and impecuniosity, it is important to remember that we are caught in but a moment of time. To quote Julian of Norwich, "This too shall pass." And borrowing from a Victorian song, let us not forget that the hero race may come and go, but it doesn't exactly die. Nonetheless, Patrick E. Firmer stands like a lone figure in a landscape lost to time. Adventurer, war hero, and writer, his deeds, the stuff of legends, lie testament to the memory of a great man, known to the Greek Andartes as the immortal Philidem. If you enjoyed this podcast and would like to learn more about one of the greatest travel writers of our time, turn to the pages of the spring edition of The Oldie Magazine, where you can read the article I wrote about Paddy Lee Fermor. The many books of Patrick Lee Fermor and W. Stanley Moss can be found online. The excerpts from Abducting a General were read by Tim Bentinck. With my thanks to Harry Mount, editor of The Oldie, from me, Harry Butnell, thank you for listening, and farewell.
And I like so busy, feel them, aman, aman, turko pula morea, maya mushis.
The closing thought, Harry, that I'm very pleased that in the Balkans, in latter years, that there was not a Paddy and a Billy on the other side looking for me.
Entitled music was performed by Kostas Moudakis. Studio editing was by Michael Stidianu. This has been a Gamekeeper production for The Oldie.